I think I'm going over that familiar territory again from a different angle, more simple, perhaps more simplistic. And because this is Philadelphia Society, just let me say, I think besides my academic work when I used to be a teaching historian, the other source for much of my thinking over the years has been Frank Meyer. And for those young people in the audience, if you haven't read In Defense of Freedom, get a copy, read it. And for us old folks, it's worth reading again. Frank, I think, understood America about as well as anybody. So, the search for the causes of American exceptionalism has been long and not altogether satisfactory. Indeed, many would say that recent history has proven that it is a mistaken search, for there is nothing exceptional to be found. A list of explanations would include the lack of a feudal past and the dominance of a homegrown liberalism, material abundance, the presence of a frontier of free land, the facts of equality, opportunity, and mobility, both physical and social, the filtering nature of immigration, that is, only certain types of people came to America, our Anglo-Saxon roots, or maybe our Anglo-Saxon Germanic roots after this moment, and I suppose other reasons as well. To this list, I would add another possibility, not as a single cause deterministic explanation, but a significant and differentiating influence, and that is the American Puritan heritage. To be much of an influence, this Puritanism has to be more than just the direct effects of the 17th century founding of the colonies of Massachusetts Bay, New Haven, Connecticut, and New Hampshire by non-separating Congregationalist dissenters within the Anglican Church, as important as this development is. Also should be included what we might call the practical Puritanism of most of the British, German, Dutch, and Huguenot settlers, both north and south, well into the 19th century. It is this practical Puritanism that is at the root of American Protestantism in general, and it goes a long way to explaining American exceptionalism. How would I characterize this practical Puritanism? To an overwhelming degree, at least after the first few decades, early American settlement of the free population came from church-going families. Their churches had substantial de facto independence and congregational control, or at least influence, on both church management and the practices of worship. If there were governing church hierarchies, they were weak in comparison to the history of European Christendom. In this regard, the scattered Catholic and Jewish congregations in America were not too different from their Protestant brethren. The great question of salvation for these Puritans was at the core of the doctrine and practice of these churches, emphasizing the importance of individual conscience and faith, the presence of sin in each person, and the need for individual initiative if salvation were to be achieved. Their view was that salvation came through grace and faith, but it was a salvation to be demonstrated by a substantial body of good works, and I want to say something more about these works in a moment. There were, of course, important differences in doctrinal understanding about these core beliefs among the different Protestant sects represented in America, differences which often obscured the underlying similarities among the churches. These similarities, however, encouraged practical cooperation across church boundaries and led to the spread of substantial, meaningful religious toleration everywhere by the mid-18th century and to the separation of church and state by the early 19th century, accompanied by a general Protestant consensus that was noted by Tocqueville, among others. To be sure, not all church members were Puritan in faith or practice, nor were all Americans churchgoers, or as we found out this morning, even believers, for that matter. Southern Anglicans, especially in the Tidewater and in the few southern cities, may have been less Puritan than most. But early Americans were a church people and relatively serious about their faith, and that faith tended more and more over time towards this homogenized Protestantism. These American Puritans understood much of their faith in terms of a covenant theology, not unique to Americans or to Protestants, but more emphasized here than elsewhere. What originally in New England was a carefully developed, rigorous interpretation of God's commands and Christian doctrine became an implicit aspect of much of the American church practice. This covenant theology led Americans to certain conclusions about the proper organization of one's life, and from those conclusions, to particular views on the nature of the good society and the state. Though salvation came through grace and faith, God had promised his people that if they would do their part, he would bring them to salvation and eternal life. Strictly speaking, salvation could not be earned through works, but the presence of good works in one's life by God's own promise was a sign of salvation. God was bound by his own promise to help those who help themselves. A comfortable thing when rightly considered, wrote one Puritan divine. In order to best prepare themselves for salvation, Puritans believed they needed regular church attendance, biblical study, and continued examination into the state of their souls and the conduct of their lives. Evidence that they did indeed do these things was taken to be evidence of likely salvation. Each individual seeking to be a good Christian needed to study his own life and habits, his strengths and weaknesses, his desires and temptations, in order to better go about his own affairs in a godly way. Then he would be a credit rather than a burden to society and a contributor to the well-being of those around him. God made self-examination the duty of all men. Proper education and attendance at a good church would help man in this task. But a truly righted life, while in and of itself not meritorious, probably belonged only to those who had assurance of salvation. These duties, or works, study, attendance on the word, self-examination, these duties required education sufficient to read the Bible, an educated clergy, a settled people, and civil peace. All these conditions were best obtained in a society of morally upright people, and such a people worked hard at their callings. By working hard to glorify God and to care for his earth, men contributed to the unfolding of God's plan. Hard work in a free land produced a prospered, ordered society that freed men from the harsh realities of physical existence, giving them better opportunities for coming to know God. And a man had many callings which served to define his place in society. As a farmer, he worked the soil. As a parent, he provided for himself and his family. As a neighbor, he lent aid and comfort where he could. As a citizen, he tried to live an exemplary life. As a ruler, he tried to be fair and just for the people and to protect their liberties so that all could follow their many callings. In the free soil of America, the successful practice of one's callings often produced riches. And the Puritan knew that he was only a steward of God's bounty, and he was not to waste his substance in luxurious living, but was to live within his means and leave behind a world more prosperous than he had found it. He knew also that though hard work produced riches, riches produced temptation, and the only cure for temptation was more self-examination and a better pursuit of one's callings. But the harder he worked, the richer he grew, and the more he prayed. Therefore, you have need pray for the repentance of your repentance and to beg the pardon of all your prayers. Just as their theology was based on covenants, these American Puritans also believed their civil polity should have a contractual basis. Sovereignty belonged to God, not man. Government, to be sure, was a necessary part of the good social order as long as magistrates confined themselves to the proper calling of their offices. Government was necessary to punish evildoers and to protect that civil peace necessary for free men to pursue their callings. But man's sinful and defective nature meant that trusting men with too much power over other men was bound to lead to corruption and to an abuse of trust. One way to check magistrates was to keep the government popular and to keep its most essential functions at the local level. Another was to use covenants and constitutions to confine government to its proper bounds. And if I might just in passing comment on the question of sovereignty that was brought up in the morning session. I really think we make a mistake when we talk about sovereignty as being a part of American political philosophy. We hear it all the time these days, and sometimes among very good conservative political thinkers and politicians. But the original conception of America, American civil polity at the national level, was there wasn't any such thing as sovereignty. The president wasn't sovereign, the Congress wasn't sovereign, even the people weren't sovereign. Because at the one time it looks like the people have some sovereignty, the moment of the constituency, at the moment they act as a constituent convention, as when they put together the constitution upon which we rely, the people were bound by the limits of the natural law. That is, they say, they couldn't put anything into the Constitution, and the Constitution itself, as Madison and Calhoun after him pointed out, was a limitation, a check on power, and not a grant of sovereign power to anything. And American political history, I think, has been a continual realization of the fact that you can't point to one thing. There's no final answer to who has power. And, of course, our modern American politicians don't like that, so they ignore that for the most part and talk as if they were sovereign, but they're not. And much of our current constitutional failings, I think, are because we've ignored this fundamental principle. Well, back to my text. These early Americans were not Democrats, but since they were property owners and responsible Puritans, government could be based on a wide franchise. Nor were they libertarian as we would define that word today. Their governments were active, busy, and ever-present, but they were also local and based on the near unanimous consent of the free adult population. As societies became more complex and diversified, and this unanimity broke down, governments, rather than expanding to stand a thwart of change, contracted their functions in order to sustain the consensus that I've been talking about. My wife read that last sentence. I think I might read it again. She said, well, gee, that's a subject for a paper all by itself. Are you sure you're right about that? And maybe we can talk about it some in the discussion if we have time. As societies became more complex and diversified, and the original unanimity broke down, rather than having more government, we had less. At least well into the middle of the 19th century. Another way to reach this same point is to take a look at the question of good works from a different angle. For these Puritans, good works could be broken down into three categories: piety, self-government, and benevolence. Piety was church-going and devotional studies. Self-government meant living a responsible life and taking care of yourself and your family so that they would not be a burden on others. Successful self-government was not possible without piety. People who had real piety were self-governed. People with piety and self-government would normally, in America, accumulate sufficient property that, if they were men, would allow them to participate in the governance of the political order as well, which was another meaning of self-government. Benevolence, or what I called elsewhere the third good work, is what we would call charity. Benevolence was a good work, and good works were required for salvation. People who were pious and self-governed would have sufficient resources for benevolence. Those needing benevolence, by this understanding, were almost by definition without piety and self-government. Puritan peoples who were in need of benevolence were ashamed of their condition. Well, what could be done for such people? I think the traditional American answer was probably very little. Those especially deserving help were those who had fallen into destitution or into temporary reverses through no fault of their own. Private or even public charity could and should provide for such people. Still, many of these people probably lacked sufficient character to be helped effectively. The best that could be done for them was to see that they go to church and that their children got some education. Attending on the word in church and in school might produce piety and self-government. The acquisition of self-governments would eliminate the need for the benevolence to begin with. So as it turns out, the most important act of benevolence, the most important third work, was to support the church and church attendance. Social welfare was dependent on church going, and churchgoers would not need much in the way of social welfare. In this manner, family, church, school, society, state, together with self-discipline and pious living, were all joined together in an interdependent web of relationships voluntarily entered into and largely organized on the local level. A society made up mostly of such Christians as those I have described here was likely to be a pretty good place to live. A society that was a pretty good place to live was likely to have a good number of saved Christians. And a society of good Christians did not need much of a state to begin with. All these characteristics were linked together by what we might now today call positive feedback mechanisms. They were mutually reinforcing characteristics. And this combination of characteristics and practices seems to me to be peculiarly American, and these familiar characteristics may legitimately be called Puritan. These Puritans emphasize the responsibility of each person for his salvation. They were dedicated to pursuing a calling. They had a highly developed sense of the need for personal integrity, virtue, and morality. They placed great importance in education for the large body of the citizenry. They believed in charity as a religious duty. They were willing to examine continually and critically the nature of their institutions. They thought the major institutions of civil society should be based on explicit popular consent. And these Americans of the founding were genuine conservatives, drawing upon medieval notions of church and social harmony, and rooting their personal and political governance in the stewardship of private property. They believed that social hierarchy and distinction were the gifts of God to man, which taught us to love each other, to aspire to self-betterment, to appreciate individual differences, to follow our calling, to choose virtuous rulers, and to show respect for those in positions of legitimate authority. They were, however, conservatives with a difference. They were American conservatives, drawing their ideals and institutions from one of the most individualistic theologies the world has ever seen. They believed in a reasonable universe, where man's reason and God's design went hand in hand. Despite the presence of sin and the fall of man, they believed that God had made them promises that gave them reason to hope for a better world and the self-confidence to get on with the business at hand in this world. That business was based on a variety of social contracts without being a creation of the Enlightenment. This was a conservatism that from the very beginning united what to some may look like incompatible strains of liberal individualism and social conservatism. But I think it should be described as a homegrown conservatism of individual liberty and responsibility combined with governmental restraint. Now, what impresses me, and this might also be a good subject for discussion in the questions and answers, what impresses me, at least in my optimistic days, is how much of American Puritanism still remains with us despite the effects of dilution and degradation and decline that the 20th century has wreaked upon the American character. We are still largely a church people. A sense of self-responsibility is still strong. The protection of private property and low taxes is still a rallying cry that politicians can ill afford to ignore. Hard work is still honored. Contracts matter. The phrase "the deserving poor" still has some meaning. People still think of families as parents and children together. The issue of character is still a concern in politics. Even many leftists would say that they believe in limited government, even if their actions belie their protestations. Yesterday, on the airplane flying down here from Indianapolis, I read Ed Fulner's wise 1997 State of Conservatism essay. And there in that essay, Ed, citing Ronald Reagan, says what conservatives should stand for today can be summarized in 5 short words: family, work, neighborhood, freedom, peace. I think that's a pretty good summary of just what I was trying to say in my remarks. We here at the Philadelphia Society, more than most, know that none of these beliefs and values are very secure anymore. We cannot assume any longer that they will prevail well into the future. But we do think they've been important in the past and have been at the strength of the American experience. But these characteristics have not dwindled to the point of vanishing, as they have in much of the rest of the West, and they can still be defended and honored in practice without embarrassment throughout this land. Such a defense, I think, is partly what the Philadelphia Society was founded for and partly what it has been about over the past 33 years. Perhaps we will be continuing that discussion for 33 more. Chairman?